All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. You know, I think if you want to discern a theme for today's show, it's got to come down to this. What's right and what's wrong? And then how do we act accordingly? At the back end of the show, we're going to rebroadcast an interview I did with Sari Makdisi, the author of Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. Before that, we're going to go back to what has become kind of a holiday tradition on this show. We're going to listen to Bob Avakian's comments on the right to eat, and why this system doesn't really give anyone the right to eat. And opening up the show, we're going to hear from Jen Marlowe, a playwright whose play There Is a Field was recently performed in staged readings in 40 countries around the world in commemoration of Black October and the murder of Jen's friend, a young Palestinian man, by the Israeli police back in 2000. I had the opportunity to talk with Jen a couple of weeks ago, and we're going to listen to that interview now. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show my first guest. Her name is Jen Marlowe. She's a playwright who has a new play called There Is a Field, and it's a play honoring a young man named Asil Asleh and remembering Black October. Jen, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Michael.
Okay, well, let's jump into this. Why don't you tell people to begin with who your play is honoring, Asil Asleh and remembering Black October. So let's let people know who Asil was and what Black October was.
Sure. Asil Asleh was an extraordinary young man. He was a Palestinian citizen of Israel. And when I first met Asil, he was 16 years old. And at that time, he was a leading participant in a peace organization, an organization called Seeds of Peace, that brought Israeli and Palestinian young people together for dialogue and reconciliation. And Asil was really one of the very star participants of this program. Just an intelligent, captivating, charming, charismatic, thoughtful, profound young man. When Asil was 17, just a little bit more than a year after I first met him, he was killed in demonstrations. There was a demonstration in his village that had erupted as part of larger demonstrations that erupted in Palestinian villages and town inside Israel. And these demonstrations were actually a part of the eruption of the Second Intifada that began in Jerusalem and then spread to the West Bank and Gaza, and demonstrations in solidarity with the Palestinians who had been killed in Jerusalem and the West Bank and Gaza. Demonstrations also started inside Israel, and Asil had been nonviolently observing one of those demonstrations when he was shot and killed, essentially executed point blank in the neck when he was lying face down, shot point blank by an Israeli police officer. And Asil was one of 12 Palestinian citizens of Israel who were killed in these demonstrations that took place during the first 8 days of October 2000. And so October 2000 became known as Black October to the community of Palestinians inside Israel.
Was that connected with the Second Intifada?
Absolutely. The demonstrations in October 2000 erupted right as the Second Intifada was erupting. The Second Intifada it was triggered when Ariel Sharon made his infamous walk on what Jews refer to as the Temple Mount, what Muslims refer to as Haram al-Sharif, the Dome of the Rock compound, and that was September 28th, 2000. The demonstrations in protest of that began on September 29th, 2000, and then after many, many unarmed Palestinians were shot and killed on September 29th and 30th, then starting on October 1st, demonstrations also began inside Israel.
Now, the murder of Asil had a major impact on you. You spent a number of years since then working, dedicating your life to telling the story of Asil in that particular moment, but also more generally, the story of Asil and the story of a subject that's rarely spoken to, which is the lives of Palestinians inside Israel.
True. I mean, it's absolutely true that Asil had an enormous impact on me. And I would say in his life and in his murder, in his death, who Asil was as a person had a tremendous impact on me and hundreds of other Israeli and Palestinians who had the chance to interact with him and to know him and to love him. Asil was one of those people who you couldn't know him but start to question the things he questioned and to look at the things he contemplated and begin to contemplate them as well. he, like I said, he was a really extraordinary young man. And when he was killed and how he was killed and the fact that there has been no justice for his killing, all of that had a tremendous impact on me. I would say that, yes, I have spent a lot of time wanting to help that story be told. And like you said, the story of Palestinians inside Israel. I would also say that much of the other social justice work that I do in the world, whether or not it's specifically related to Palestine, although I believe that everything is interrelated, a lot of that I think was inspired by Aseel as well. I consider him one of my main inspirations in the work that I do in the world generally.
Very, very interesting. Now, how did that lead to? I mean, you were actually, I think primarily you're a documentary filmmaker, aren't you?
I don't know what I am primarily. I'm primarily, I think, a human rights activist, and I use documentary films and writing and now this play and all these other means of communication. I consider them tools to expose through personal stories what I think are very important issues.
Mm-hmm. And how did writing a play come to be the way that you were going to dig into Aseel's story?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. I don't really know. All I know is that very early on, I knew I wanted to help make sure Aseel's story was told, and I just knew somehow, instinctively, that it would be a play, and I knew that it would be a documentary-style play, that it would not be me recreating the events and the dialogue. It would not be based on a true story play, but that it would actually be comprised of people's real words as they spoke them and wrote them, including Aseel's real words. My background had been in theater before I got into documentary film, and so at the time that I first started working on the play, which was not long after Aseel's murder, I think I still had my head in theater. Documentary filmmaking, ironically enough, came afterwards, but although I started working in documentary film afterwards, I ended up making and completing two feature-length documentary films before I completed the play, which had its roots in my earlier work, which had been theater.
A quick reminder, you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with playwright Jen Marlowe about her play There Is a Field, which is about the murder of her friend Aseel Asla by the Israeli police during Black October back in 2000. And more generally, it's about the lives of Palestinians living inside the State of Israel today. Well, let's jump into this because There Is a Field, which is the name of the play. As you said, it was made up mainly or entirely of documentary material, but it's not in the same way that you often see other documentary style plays, which, you know, have sort of either reading or people in acting, you know, the playwright even in acting or a performance artist in acting all of the various characters. You've actually taken this documentary material and molded it into what I think, and having seen it, I was very moved by it, and as was the audience that I saw it with, it was, you know, a very moving, a very powerful play that laid out the life of Aseel, the murder of Aseel, and many of the big questions without being didactic at all, really opening up a much needed conversation about all this.
Thank you for saying that. That's one of the reasons why I'm glad that I took as much time as I did with this play. If I had finished it as quickly as I had originally intended, which I wanted to get this play written right away because the issue felt so urgent to me, I think it might have been a more traditional docudrama type of format, which is often, like you said, a patchwork of different people's voices, sometimes just with one actor or different actors, but more of just a patchwork of different perspectives and voices. And I think because I focused on the story of Aseel's sister primarily, and although it's a story about Aseel, his sister Nardine really is the main character. And because the backbone of this play became a series of interviews that I did with Nardine over an 8-year period, it actually allowed Nardine as a character, she's of course a real person, but now in the play she is a character, it allowed her to have a journey, which has a dramatic arc that wouldn't have happened if I banged the play out a year or even 2 or 3 years after Aseel's death. It took those 8 years for Nardine to have that journey, for her to grapple with questions of how she is going to live her life in response to the murder of her brother. And I think that's why, although it is all documentary material, that's why it feels more like a play in terms of the structure of a journey and a story and a dramatic arc.
Well, it was really fascinating to me that, you know, some of the materials that you used, including emails directly between Asil and his sister, as well as conversations, interviews you've had with Nardine and with other members of his family, and actually being able to sculpt that into a thing that actually poses contradictions and serves as an engine that moves the story in a very compelling way. And it, how hard was it to do that, to look at all these emails, particularly of someone you were close to?
Very challenging, and I do have to say that I could not have done it alone. I had a lot of help. There was some very good friends and colleagues that put their eyes on the script, particularly my friend and my colleague, Ed Mast, who is a playwright in Seattle, Washington. He was really a huge help and guidance in taking this mountain of primary source material and trying to figure out what is the essence of this story and helping me realize that it is really a Nardine story. And I think with anything, this is also true of my documentary films, you become very close to the material and then it becomes hard to cut and hard to edit. And this was especially true because of the nature of this material, and especially true when it was Asil's own words. It was any time I cut a line from something that Asil wrote, that was hard, that was painful. It felt like I was cutting a tiny little piece of Asil that could be seen. But like with any art form, you also have to ask yourself, what is serving the larger story? And so, yes, it was challenging and it was difficult to take this mountain of material, all of which felt very precious to me, and edit and cut it and arrange it to tell this particular story. And of course, this story, although I think it does touch on many of the complexities and gets at a lot of the heart of the issues, it's still incomplete. There's so much that had to be left out.
Now, you did this play, and I don't know whether initially you just were writing the play to produce the play and to get it out into the world, but eventually it became part of a much larger campaign that I assume you were actually part, sort of the engine behind that, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And actually, I'm sort of embarrassed to admit it, but it didn't even occur to me until this past March that October 2000, which was just a few months away at that point, was the 10-year anniversary. I just somehow I hadn't wrapped my brain around the realization that October 2010 was the 10-year anniversary of Black October and of Asil's murder. And when I did first realize that, I was having coffee with that same friend, Ed Mast, who had been the dramaturg on the script. And at the beginning of having coffee with him, we were sitting down to talk about, well, October 2nd is the 10-year anniversary of Asil's murder. Let's premiere the play on October 2nd. And where should we premiere it? Should we do it in Seattle? Should we try to do it in New York, in London? And by the end of having that cup of coffee with Ed, I had decided and that the way to do this was as a grassroots activist global call to theatrical action, and that I wouldn't just try to premiere it in a theater in a city, but that I would essentially put a call out to the world to mark this very significant anniversary of Black October, an anniversary that largely has gone unnoticed by the world. Like you mentioned, the issues facing Palestinians inside Israel are largely unnoticed. Friends of mine who are Palestinians from inside Israel describe themselves as the forgotten Palestinians. So I realized that there was an opportunity with this significant anniversary and with this play, not only to remember Asil, not only to mark the anniversary of Black October, but to inject into the wider Israel-Palestine discourse issues that face Palestinians inside Israel. And it was amazing to see how many communities in the world responded throughout the month of October in over 40 different communities in 18 different countries in 8 different languages. People performed, read in one way or the other, experienced, there is a field, experienced the play.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with human rights activist, documentary filmmaker, and playwright Jen Marlowe about her play, There Is a Field. This play, which digs into the lives of Palestinian people living inside Israel, was recently performed around the world to mark the 10th anniversary of the day the Israeli police murdered Jen's friend, Asil Asla. Well, it's interesting when you see, I think there's a piece on YouTube that is a reading of a poem that Asil wrote.
An email that Asil wrote on March 30th, 1998.
Yeah, very poetic email. And that was kind of interesting to see that the way that happened, whether you agree with what he's saying or not, the idea that just the people could come together and read these words was actually very interesting to me.
And And of course, in many ways, that the concept of having this beautiful email of a seal's, which he titled Peaceful Thoughts, having that read, it was read by 22 people from all over the world, and each person took the lines that they were given and translated into their own languages. So it contains the beauty of 18 different languages. And if anyone just Googles Peaceful Thoughts on YouTube, they can find the video. And in many ways, that video is some form of a realization of a seal's dream, his dream. And in his writings, he talks about a world which he is represented for him by the field that Rumi mentions. When Rumi says, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. For a seal, that field was a place where there were no borders separating people. There were no checkpoints separating people. People didn't have different identity cards that labeled them as Jew or Arab or Pakistani or American, that people were all equal. And in that quote of Rumi's, which starts out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field, I'll meet you there. In some ways, this video was that meeting place of people from all over the world who, through a seal's writing and through a seal's beliefs, were coming together to make that statement.
In that, it's a very controversial thing, because in that, even people taking that stand and actually reading that email, in a way, had already decided. They haven't gone beyond what's right and wrong. They've actually made a decision to a certain extent that something's right and something's wrong. They seem to me, anyway, maybe I'm reading more into it, but they seem to me to be standing with what was right. And I thought, from the experience I had seeing the play, that was a big question for the audience, is how do you, you know, and it was the question that you presented to people in the play, that Nardine presents to people, but you did in the way you fashioned it, that there's not moral relativism here, that some actions are wrong, some actions are right, and that clearly the murder of a seal and what's happening to the Palestinians inside Israel is actually, they were wrong. And then then people are confronted with, what do you do with that? And I'm kind of curious about, you've played in, at this point, what, 30 readings around the world?
There's been 40, actually.
40, okay. Do you have any idea, now, let me ask you this, did you attend every one of those readings?
No, I wish I could have. there was no way, especially as, you know, many of them were happening on the same day. I attended about, I think, 6 of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, what was the response of the audience in response to the play and the questions, the controversies that are posed in the play? What was the response of the audiences?
The response has been very, very strong in every single one of the performances that I've had the opportunity to witness. What was really, really interesting was the response in the reading I was just witnessing on Saturday night, which was in Derry, north of Ireland. And the people doing the reading, the folks actually reading the script, were family members, many of them, of people who were killed on Bloody Sunday, which happened on January 30th, 1972, when 13 unarmed protesters were gunned down by British paratroopers in Derry, Northern Ireland. So the parallels of that and the emotion of that and the experiences that are presented in the play so much mirror this community in Derry. Very, very powerful parallels. But I think audiences have left, and I hope this is true even in the readings that I didn't witness, struggling with some of those questions. It is really presented in many ways as a dialogue between Aseel and Nardine. Some of these questions about, like you said, is there right and wrong? Is it possible to forgive? Does this field that Aseel dreams of, and does that field really exist? Is it possible to go beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing? And I think Nardine and Aseel represent two very different points of views on those questions, and on the questions of whether dialogue between Israelis and Palestinians is the most effective way to reach a situation of justice. Is that the most important work to be done? I think these are very important questions, and I have my own opinions on the answers to those questions, but I don't seek to resolve them in the play. I seek to open them up, and I hope that audiences leave very deeply thinking about them.
Well, I can say for sure that the audience I saw it with, it was interesting, because I walked out with someone that, you know, I had met just briefly a while back, who was actually part of the play and was one of the readers. And, you know, we were sort of reestablishing a connection. And I'll tell you, the main thing, we just talked for quite a while, you know, walking around the block instead of just going to our cars and going home, to actually, you know, to dig into what were the questions, how things were posed. So I thought, and even looking at the talk back you had after that reading, it was very interesting that the kinds of the ways that people really began to grapple with gigantic questions. And to me, you know, there's no question in my mind that a field where those kinds of things like, you know, there's no borders, there's no nationalities, there's no oppression, there's no exploitation, there's no, none of that exists. That field is possible, and it does exist in a, to a certain extent in a virtual existence in the future. But whether we do what's right or wrong has a lot to do with whether we as a species can get there. You know, which
I could not have put that better myself. I mean, that's exactly how I would. That's exactly how I would describe it.
Well, here's a question for you. This clearly, this isn't, even though you had the 10th anniversary performances, this clearly is something that seems designed to take on a life of its own to a certain extent. Is there plans for like continuing readings around the world? Are there ways that people who might want to, you know, get involved in taking up this play, are there things that they can do to do that?
Absolutely. My intent was always to launch it during this 10-year anniversary with the intent of it having a life above and beyond the significance of this anniversary. There were some theaters and some groups and some people who were not able to do it in October, and so there are still more readings that are being planned already for November and December. I'm making contacts with different theaters around the world. People are contacting me. If anyone's interested in getting a copy of the script, looking at it, organizing a reading, I hope that they will go to my website, which is donkeysaddle.org, and on the website there's ways to contact me, because I do believe that this play should and will have a life as a piece of theater, as a piece of art.
And let me just repeat that. It's donkeysaddle.org. Donkey like as in donkey, like the thing that you ride. I don't know if I'm...
As in hee-haw, exactly. Yeah,
there you go. There's the easiest way. Hee-haw.
Donkey as in hee-haw, and then saddle is what you would wear on the donkey's back.
There you go. Donkeysaddle.org. Jen, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Michael. It was great
sure.
to talk to you.
And thanks for the play. I really enjoyed it. Really got a lot out of it.
Thank you.
Okay. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with human rights activist, documentary filmmaker, and playwright Jen Marlowe about her play, There Is a Field. It's a play about the murder of a young Palestinian living inside Israel by the Israeli police during a demonstration in what became known as Black October. Now, this play is guaranteed to stimulate intense discussion over some of the most important issues in the world today, and it's attracted an audience worldwide. You can access the script or get in touch with Jen at donkeysaddle.org. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Bob Avakian commenting on the right to eat and why this system can't even guarantee that most basic right. So stay tuned. Okay, this has sort of become a seasonal tradition on this show. For the next 4 or 5 weeks, this society will be awash in cheer. Religious holidays, secular holidays, and on and on. And a running theme will be goodwill to everyone. Along with various nodal points characterized by the traditional eat until you burst syndrome. So in light of this, every year, I strive to inject a sense of reality into all of it by offering up these comments from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. The right to eat. So take a listen.
Well, let's come at the nature of the capitalist system from another angle, one which I've spoken to previously. The right to eat. Here there's mass starvation and mass malnutrition among billions of people, a very large section of the population of human beings on the earth today, who are not getting enough to eat, just to take something very basic. Now, if you step back from the particulars of the way the world is, you hear people say, well, that's the way the world is. That's just the way life is. Life is not fair. Life ain't shit by itself. Life does not exist in a vacuum or an abstract. Life exists through the working out of contradictions rooted in the basic contradictions of a system that prevails at a given time. That's what goes on, not life in some abstract sense that somehow exists up in the sky unrelated to what's going on, or, you know, some force that works its way through human beings in some mystical sense. The reason, quote-unquote, life is not fair is because the capitalist system operates according to certain dynamics. And one of them is that most of the people in the world scramble to have barely enough to eat or don't succeed in having enough to eat. That is a daily existence for the majority of humanity. Now, if you step back from it, you would say to yourself, well, what could be more basic than the right to eat? What is more essential to life than the basic right to eat and to have some shelter and to have clothes? But in a concentrated sense, the right to eat. What could be more basic? How can it be that you have a world in which there is no right to eat? In which the great majority of humanity either does not have enough to eat or has to scuffle every day to try to get enough to eat. How can that be? Especially amidst all the wealth there is in the world that surrounds and mocks people at every turn. Once again, materialism, dialectical materialism, teaches us that this is because of the fundamental production relations of capitalism. The fundamental contradiction of capitalism between the socially produced wealth and the private capitalist accumulation of that wealth by aggregations of competing capitalists. By the very phenomenon that's described by the preliminary transformation into capital, by the phenomenon of the need for capital to reproduce itself, not to reproduce social wealth to be distributed according to the needs of the people, but to reproduce itself as capital on an expanded scale. There's a vast difference between reproducing wealth on an expanded scale, which can be and is applied to meet social needs, and reproducing wealth on an expanded basis as capital. And in understanding that difference, you understand fundamental things about why the world is the way it is and how it could be radically different. The fact that there is no right to eat, something which was pointed out in the book Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That in other places, has to do once again with Marx's statement that right can never be higher than the economic structure of society and the culture conditioned thereby. In other words, because of the basic character of capitalist production relations and the fundamental contradiction of capitalism to which I've just spoken, there can be and there is no right to eat. You eat or don't eat according to the dictates of the dynamics of capitalist accumulation. If you can contribute to the reproduction of capital on an expanded scale in profitable enough terms for this or that capitalist or aggregation of capital, you can eat to one degree or another. If you do not or cannot in a given time or circumstances, you cannot eat unless you go find some other way to get something to eat, which is what some people, for example, who've been basically locked out of the economic system, repeatedly strive to do. But they have no right to eat. If you step back and you say, what could be more basic to human association than the right of its the members who make up that association, or the people, the human beings who make up that human association, to eat? But it doesn't matter that that's a fundamental human need. It doesn't translate, that fundamental human need does not translate into a fundamental human right within the confines of the fundamental contradiction and the production relations and corresponding social relations and superstructure, including the laws of capitalist society. There's a fundamental need. There's no fundamental right. Why? Once again, because of the production relations, the social relations, and the corresponding superstructure, including politics and law, and the enforcement of law within the confines of a capitalist system. Or let's look at the parasitism of imperialism, which I've spoken to several points in the course of this talk. I referred to Marx's statement about the rosy dawn of capitalism, the entombment in the minds of millions of native peoples in Bolivia and other parts of Latin, what we call Latin America today. slavery, exploitation of child labor. This was the rosy dawn of the initial capitalist accumulation, sometimes called primitive accumulation of the capitalist system as a whole. But what is it today? What is the character and driving force of capitalist accumulation today in capitalism's stage of imperialism, its worldwide system of exploitation? It is exactly the reproduction on an even broader and more intense level in many ways of what Marx was describing sardonically and ironically in talking about the rosy dawn of capitalism. It is child labor, not just in one or a few countries in Europe, but on a massive scale, in the hundreds of millions. It is conditions of labor for masses of people, hundreds of millions, which are barely better than conditions of slavery. And not only conditions of labor, but conditions of life more broadly. It is the turning of human beings on a massive scale into the means to make wealth for others, even in the most degrading terms, such as the large-scale sex trade that goes on internationally today under imperialism. Throughout the world, this rosy dawn is being repeated in the twilight years of capitalism and what we must make the twilight and final years of capitalism in a broad historical sense. This is still the foundation of capitalism and imperialism. We must never allow people to be fooled by the fact that people go to business school, wear suits that cost in the thousands of dollars, and can speak an articulate language. They are still, not everyone who does that, but those who are representatives of this system are still standing on that pulpit of bones. They are still standing on the children who labor in horrific conditions every day of the week, 12 hours a day. They are still standing on the bodies of people torn to shred in the wars to enforce this exploitation. They are still standing on the bodies, broken and degraded, of the women who were traded like commodities, and even worse in this system. They are still standing on the bodies of people all over the world who were driven from one set of horrendous conditions to even worse ones, uprooted and flung across the globe in the desperate search for some kind of life. They are still standing on that foundation. That is still the rosy nature of their system, no matter how they dress it up and no matter what intellectual accoutrements it may take on, what intellectual dress it may take on. And please understand, this is not an attack on intellectuals. I'm talking about the intellectual rationalizations and the people who speak as representatives and apologists and defenders of the capitalist system, whom you see go out and speak in refined terms. But that is refinement dripping with blood. It is what Malcolm X said, a bloody-jawed wolf with blood running down its jaw. It's like the movie Them or whatever it was, where you had to have special glasses to see the hyena-like nature of the people who were among us. This is the nature of this ruling class. This is not exaggeration or communist rhetoric and hyperbole. This is a reality which I am struggling to describe, to find the terms to describe in its full horrific dimensions. And we should understand this fully.
That was Bob Avakian speaking on the right to eat. There is none for the vast majority of people in an imperialist world. If you want to check out some of Bob Avakian's work, go to bobavakian.net. We're going to take another short break and be right back with Sari Makdisi, talking about what it means to be living in occupied Palestine today.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night, while the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right.
Welcome back. That's Michael Hart, H-E-A-R-T. We will not go down, Gaza.
Following up on our earlier discussion of Jen Marlowe's play about Palestine and Israel and the oppression of the Palestinian people living inside the state of Israel, I thought it would be good if we got a little bit more of a historical and political sense of what it actually means to live as a Palestinian today, both in the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza, as well as in occupied Palestine overall, or what's commonly known as Israel today. And I feel this is especially important given all the rabid fascistic policies and actions that seem to be coming to the fore even more in Israel today. So I dug into the archives and decided to rebroadcast an interview I did with Sari Makdisi, the author of Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. This interview was conducted during the Israeli war on Gaza in early 2009. So let's get into it.
I'm very happy to welcome back to the show now someone who's been on at least once, maybe twice before, Sari Makdisi. And Sari is a professor of English and comparative literature at UCLA. He's also a much-published commentator and author around the Middle East, and in particular, questions of Palestine. And his book is Palestine Inside Out, An Everyday Occupation. If you want to know what it means to be in an – if you want to get a good grounding in the situation of the Palestinian people, you want to get a good grounding in what's going on with Palestine and what it means to be living under occupation, this book is a must. Okay, it's out – published by Norton. It's Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. Sari, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. There's an abysmal ignorance, almost an enforced ignorance in this country about the Palestinian people and the truth about Palestine and Israel. And even in terms of people understanding, what do we mean by occupied territory? So I was wondering if you could, you know, briefly give people a capsulized understanding of why are these Palestinian places referred to as occupied territories?
That's actually a great question, and there are, in fact, two different kinds of occupations that are at stake. The first, the most obvious, and the one that's conventionally used in the West in particular, refers to the occupation of Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, which fell to Israel in 1967, during the 1967 war. And that, when people refer to the occupied territories, they almost always mean Gaza, West Bank, and East Jerusalem. Of course, the Syrian Golan Heights also fell in the same war, and the Egypt-Sinai Peninsula at the same time. I think those are separate issues because those were never part of Palestine. So if we're talking about Palestinian territories occupied in 1967, we mean Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. But the interesting thing about Gaza in particular is that, in fact, almost everybody, well, 80% of the population of Gaza, consists of refugees or the descendants of refugees who were expelled from the rest of southwestern Palestine in 1948, when most of Palestine was turned into a Jewish state, the Jewish State of Israel. So when the Zionist project to create a Jewish state in what had been an overwhelmingly non-Jewish land was actualized in 1948, there would have been too many non-Jews in the space controlled by the Jewish state for it to be seriously call itself the Jewish state, and they were basically removed. And that's what happened in 1948. So, in a way, there's another occupation, which is the occupation of most of the rest of Palestine that took place in 1948. So, to make a very long story very short, about 80% of Palestine was taken over and turned into the Jewish state of Israel in 1948, and then the remainder of Palestine, the remaining 20 or so percent, fell to Israel in 1967 in the form of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, which were basically the leftovers of what had been Palestine. So what we have now is if you look at all of what had been Palestine, it's under the control of one state, the State of Israel, even though, in fact, Israel doesn't include the residents of what we call the occupied territories as citizens. They're still under its control, clearly, and they have been for 41 years. But in the overall territory, there are roughly equal populations of Jews and Palestinians. It's just that Jews have rights and Palestinians don't, or they have different kinds of rights. And that's what's really at issue, I think, in this whole conflict.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're listening to a rebroadcast of a discussion with Sari Makdisi, the author of Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. This discussion was originally broadcast in January of 2009 in the wake of the savage Israeli attack on the people of Gaza.
Now, you know, one of the things I wanted to also to make clear to people is that when you were talking about 1948, and I mean, just to reemphasize to people, Palestine at that time, 93% of the people were Palestinian Arabs.
Well, 1948, it was more like two-thirds rather than 93%. When the Zionist movement, which was a European movement, that's very important to emphasize that, when the Zionist movement declared its intention to create a Jewish state and it got the support of the British Empire to create a Jewish homeland in Palestine, or a state in Palestine, in the early 20th century, at that point, you're right, the Jewish population of Palestine was only about 7% of the overall. So they wanted to take a country that had a 7% Jewish population and turn it into a Jewish country, which obviously requires either, you know, extreme imagination or great persuasive power or violence, ultimately. And obviously it's the latter that the Israelis fell to realize their state. The other thing it's important to emphasize is that, as I said, this is a European project, so the Jewish population of Palestine that had been there before the Zionist movement set its sights on Palestine was Palestinian. It was as much Palestinian and as much Arab, by the way, as Palestine's Muslim and Christian population. So it wasn't the idea to transform this land into an exclusively Jewish state is expressly a European project, and it has to be seen in the context of the climax of European colonialism at the end of the 19th century, which is when modern Zionism was born. So
right.
All these contexts are in play.
Yeah, and it's extremely important because I do think people too often that the mythology and so much is tied up with the horror of the Holocaust, and the mythology that gets promoted is that somehow Israel was formed as a response to the Holocaust, and it had nothing to, you know, that was not why Israel was formed. Israel was formed actually, which had a lot more to do with the combination, the sort of getting together the coincidental or coinciding of the interests of the Zionists and all the stuff they had going and the interests of the imperialists in that region. And to me, it's very important for people to understand that there was Palestine. There were hundreds of thousands of Palestinian people kicked out who don't have the right to return. You make a point in your book, that what's happening in Gaza today is actually rooted in what happened in 1948. And I think this is what we've been talking about, an extremely important point.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, if you look at the situation again, why are all these people packed into Gaza? Gaza is a tiny territory. It's about a third the size of Los Angeles, and it's one of the most densely populated territories in the world. And you have to ask, why are these people all there? What are they? I mean, the economic base of the territory can't really, in the long run, sustain a population of this size. And you have to remember also that Gaza is an extremely young place. Half the people in Gaza are children. So when you think about all the bombing and destruction that's been going on, and in fact the systematic starvation of the territory over the past 3 years, half the people who have been bombed, and a large proportion of the casualties, a third of the casualties actually, are children, which is just something that everybody has to bear in mind as we talk about Gaza. But yeah, what does it mean that this territory, which has been isolated from the outside world, it's been systematically cut off by Israeli forms of control, has this population that really doesn't belong there. It belongs back home where it came from, in the rest of Palestine, and yet they're bottled into this territory. And not only have they been cut off from the outside world, now they've been bombed with weapons like phosphorus and dense inert metal explosives and other and high explosives and other forms of weaponry, that it is unimaginable to think of any other state in the world using against such an entrapped population. I mean, so for example, it's often said Israel has the right to defend itself from these rocket attacks. And people often make the comparison, imagine if there were rockets coming over the border from Tijuana into San Diego, wouldn't we do something, or from Canada into Seattle or whatever, wouldn't we do something? And of course, what's not said in the analogy is that, you know, the U.S. isn't occupying either Mexico or Canada, so that automatically disqualifies the comparison. A much closer comparison would be the violence unleashed in the IRA bombing campaign inside Britain in the 1970s. And it's worth pointing out, first of all, that the IRA killed way more people in England in the 1970s than had been killed by all the rocket attacks ever fired from Gaza into Israel. And second of all, it is impossible to imagine, and it just didn't happen historically. Anyway, it's impossible to imagine the British sealing off Northern Ireland from the outside world, cutting off supplies of food, water, electricity, fuel, and so forth, and then unleashing the Royal Air Force to drop high explosive and phosphorus and cluster bombs and so forth on a trapped population, in densely packed civilian neighborhoods, to drop these kinds of weapons. And I think what that raises is then the question of, well, how could this happen? What does it mean that an entrapped, besieged, starving, thirsty, desperate population is being bombed with these kinds of weapons on this kind of scale? And I think people have to think through what their own answers are to that question, that this could happen to an entire civilian population, that the excuses about rocket fire, nobody's justifying firing rockets into Israel, but nevertheless, the excuse doesn't hold water. The historical comparisons, the closest one, as I said, is the IRA in England. The reaction is just of a totally different order of magnitude.
Let me break in here for a minute, Sari, and remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and I'm talking with Sari Makdisi, the author of Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. And we're talking about the occupied territories, and we're talking about the nature of the occupation so people can get an understanding of where this comes from. And Sari, one of the points that you make, I think this point that you're getting into is an important point to pursue. You know, one of the things that I had Richard Falk on the show, and he made the point that when you look at the response of the Palestinians, that there's actually, that he would look at that, and he said this may be, you could look at that, if you wanted to call that a crime, you could look at that and say it's a crime of survival. But he also made the point, and you've made the point too, that when a territory is occupied, there is the right to resist that occupation. And I want people to understand, you've done a remarkable job in your book, as I said, of painting what it means to be occupied. Just the daily life. Can you give people a sense of what it means to be living in the occupied territories, in Gaza?
Oh, to live in Gaza means that you are completely cut off from the outside world. And again, the other thing about this is that it's not Israel cutting off Gaza from the outside world has nothing to do with either suicide bombing or rocket attacks, although those are the pretexts used most recently. Gaza was systematically cut off from the outside world in 1991 by the Israelis when they imposed the first comprehensive closure. And then the closure became sort of institutionalized in 1993. And the first wave of suicide bombings came after that inside Israel, and rocket attacks weren't until 2000. The first lethal rocket attack wasn't until 10 years later, 2004. So all this predates the kinds of responses. So what it means that you can't come, you can't go, you can't work, you can't study, you can't visit, you can't do anything unless you have basically Israel's acquiescence in doing so. That's the case in Gaza in an extreme way. It's the case also in the West Bank and also for Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem. And it's the case to a less extent, although it's still the case, for Palestinian citizens of the state of Israel itself, Israel within its pre-67 borders. Israel often says that its Palestinian citizens are treated equally. In fact, it doesn't even call them Palestinian citizens, it calls them Israeli Arabs, although they're Palestinian as the people in the West Bank or in Gaza. But inside Israel itself, they too are subject to all kinds of forms of discrimination, like they can't access land because land is held in the name of the Jewish people. If they're not Jewish, they don't have access to it. And there are other kinds of things, other basic rights that they're denied. But in the occupied territories, to live under occupation means not to have any control over your own day-to-day life. All aspects of life are ultimately held in check by Israel. To travel, you need a permit. To dig a well, you need a permit. To go to the next town, you need a permit. To get a job, you need a permit. To go to the hospital, you need a permit. Everything you do requires a permit, and the permits only come from the Israeli army. So it's a form of life that is, it's not life. It's really a form of suffocation. Yeah, but which and obviously it gives right. It produces acts of resistance, not all of them legitimate. I'm sorry to say, plenty of them are legitimate, but there are obviously acts of resistance that aren't legitimate, like firing rockets at civilians. You're not supposed to do that under any circumstance.
Yeah, but there's a difference between that and actually one of the things that Richard, one of the points that Richard was making, I think you actually indicate this in your book too, and in particular where you talk about, I'll probably mispronounce the man's name, but Arnon Sofer.
Yeah,
and a really despicable comment he made, because everything you're describing is and another aspect of living in an occupied territory, living under the Zionist occupation in Palestine. Actually, it's backed up by massive and just horrifying military might that's meant to reduce the Palestinian people to subhumans. The war crimes actually were even they predate the outbreak of this massacre, that actually the collective punishment, the targeting of civilians, these are all things that have been going on continuously in Gaza and the West Bank.
Yeah, as I said, Gaza was first isolated by the Israelis. Having been occupied in 67, it was first systematically cut off from the outside world by the Israelis in 1991, long before suicide bombing, decade before, or more than a decade before rockets. And as I said, when it cuts off the territory, half the people that are cut off are children. So what does it mean for Israel to cut off supplies of food and fuel and electricity and water to children, leading to the United Nations documenting, alarmingly documenting, rising malnutrition, skyrocketing rates of anemia in children in particular, and the first signs of actual, the beginnings of starvation? What does it mean that an entire population is being deliberately, and going back to that quotation from Arnon Sofer, premeditatively cut off from supplies of food it needs to survive? This isn't like, it's not the first case of famine, clearly, but famine typically happens because of misappropriation or corruption, or the food doesn't get through, or there's some natural disaster. But this is a case of deliberately, premeditatedly reducing an entire population to a subhuman existence. And the words of Israeli planners, Arnon Sofer is one of them, the Israeli government advisor Dov Weisglass joked in 2006 that he wants to put the Palestinian people on what he called a diet. That's a quotation. Again, I mean, they're perfectly explicit in what they're talking about. And then on top of the diet they've been put on, as I said, this encircled population that has no escape, there are no bomb shelters in Gaza for most people, and there's nowhere to escape. The doors are all closed. So you have 1.5 million people, half of them children, packed into a territory from which there's no escape and in which there's no shelter. And then not only have they been starved for 3 years, they've been subject to 3 weeks of round-the-clock bombardment by these unbelievably devastating weapons like phosphorus, for example. And, you know, again, I think your listeners need to step back, and I'm not going to say for them what's going on. Let everybody, for him or herself, think, what does it mean when you do this to an entire population, especially given that you're doing it in a way that goes back years and years and years and years, and the people that you're doing it to are people that were removed from the state in 1948, 61 years ago, in order to make room for the creation of a state that has one exclusive ethno-religious identity, as symbolized on its flag, in which there's no room for all the other forms of ethno-religious identification that had historically prevailed in Palestine. It's important to remember, Palestine, historically, for hundreds of years, has been an incredibly diverse and heterogeneous place. All kinds of cultures and religions and ethnicities lived there. And yet, to turn it into a state with one ethnic and religious identification involves a kind of act, all these acts of violence that, as I said, pre-exist Hamas, pre-exist rockets, pre-exist all the forms of resistance, legitimate and illegitimate, that have come in response to them. And I think we've reached a point now where, with the viciousness of this last round of bombing, people should see what's going on, and they should see it for what it is, I think. And we need to move now to make sure that this doesn't go on happening, because the longer we allow it to happen, the more children are going to die.
Siri, you know, at one point that you made, and we won't be able to talk about it, maybe I'll have you back sometime soon to talk about this other point in your book, but the point about the aim of the Zionists, really, to turn the Palestinian people, their consciousness, in the deepest recesses of their consciousness, to turn them into a defeated people. And you have to look at that also in conjunction with the people who facilitate this kind of atrocity, the U.S., the British, the Russians, the, you know, the whole quartet that's operating there. And it really does need, the people of the world need to stand up and stop this.
Absolutely, yeah.
That was Siri Makdisi, author of Palestine Inside Out, An Everyday Occupation. You know, I hope you enjoyed today's show. I followed this theme out because I think it's important for all of us to be wrestling with what's actually right and wrong in the world today, and on that basis, figuring out what's right and acting accordingly. Similarly, that's why I also ran Bob Avakian's piece on the right to eat. Big questions are posed by what's happening in the world today, and among the sharpest is whether this is the best humanity can do. Well, I do believe that the world is crying out for fundamental revolutionary change. There's a better way we should be and could be living, but we have to bring it alive. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. I also want to thank my guests and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. You know, one more tradition that I've tried to institute on this show over the last few years, we're going to go out now with William S. Burroughs and his Thanksgiving prayer. Enjoy.
For John Dillinger, and hope he is still alive. Thanksgiving Day, November 28th, 1986. Thanks for the wild turkey and the passenger pigeons, destined to be shit out through wholesome American guts. Thanks for a continent to despoil and poison. Thanks for Indians to provide a modicum of challenge and danger. Thanks for vast herds of bison to kill and skin, leaving the carcasses to rot. Thanks for bounties on wolves and coyotes. Thanks for the American dream to vulgarize and falsify until the bare lies shine through. Thanks for the KKK, for nigger killing lawmen feeding their nachos, for decent church-going women with their mean, pinched, bitter, evil faces. Thanks for killer queer for Christ stickers. Thanks for laboratory AIDS. Thanks for prohibition and the war against drugs. Thanks for a country where nobody's allowed to mind his own business. Thanks for a nation of finks. Yes, thanks for all the memories. All right, let's see your arms. You always were a headache and you always were a bore. Thanks for the last and greatest betrayal of the last and greatest of human dreams.